Hello. So what I wanted to talk about today was a series of mainly experiments that were done by my former PhD student, Remy Kosu, who's just moving to Australia this week to start a new job. And I'll end up with a little bit of geological application. And the idea is that when we have a gravity current or turbidity current flowing down a channelized flow, at high latitudes, the Coriolis forces can deflect the flow in such a way that it appears the erosion and deposition patterns can change. And so that's the hypothesis that we're putting forward, that there could be these large-scale geological impacts of that. And I'll try and present the evidence we have towards that. And I'd really welcome any feedback any real geologists have about this. So this is, part of this work was done with Anna Wallin, who's an oceanographer in Sweden, and Jeffrey Peekle, who's a sedimentologist in the UK. So this picture up here is actually my main result, so I'll start with that. Here we have a laboratory rotating table. We can change the Coriolis force by changing the spinning rate. And within there, we have a channel. It's about 10 centimeters wide. Here, the flow is about 5 centimeters deep. Here, we're looking upstream. When there's no background rotation, the flow comes towards us and it has a flat upper interface. When it's rotating strongly in the northern hemisphere sense, the flow is deflected to the right and the interface tilts to the right. And when it's rotating in the southern hemisphere sense, it deflects to the left and tilts to the left. And I'll show you in a bit of detail how the velocity fields also change and when we add erosion and deposition and sinuous channels, how that also changes. But just keep in mind, this is the main result I want you to remember. No, it's not working. Oh, no, I just got this little mouse that's... Ah, here we go. Okay. So, there's two questions. I want to ask, how does Coriolis force change the circulation patterns in gravity currents? So not necessarily ones that are moving sediments. And then if we have these, if we understand the basic dynamics of a saline gravity current and we add in sediments, how does it change the erosion and depositional patterns in sinuous channels? So this one we understand very well. This one we understand the fluid dynamics of reasonably well, but how this applies to geology, we're still trying to work out to some extent. So this is the geological motivation. Eckhart Myberg talked about this a little bit in his talk, and a few other people as well. Submarine canyons on the continental shelf bring a lot of suspended sediment, bring a lot of sediment that comes ultimately from rivers. Once this flows down onto the abyssal plain where it's relatively flat, we get these distributary channel systems that can be very long. Sometimes they're tens, hundreds of kilometers long. And usually they're sinuous, is the observation. This is being studied by a lot of geologists. As several people have mentioned, they're quite important for oil companies because the sedimentary features that get built up here are rich hydrocarbon targets. They're also important because I think maybe about half of the sedimentary, half of the rocks that are sedimentary ultimately come from turbidites. Maybe a geologist could correct me on that. So they're very important geologically. And trying to understand ancient records, you want to have a good understanding of what the processes that led to the evolution of these channel systems. They can grow for tens of thousands of years, and then we're interested in understanding the stratigraphy down below. So I'm really going to be looking at what are the processes that occur in these sinuous channels. So here's a picture of the Amazon. In this case, the submarine channel is 800 kilometers long. You can see it's got a few abandoned meanders, and this is near the equator, and it's a highly sinuous channel wiggling along. The radius of curvature is relatively small, just a couple of kilometers. And so these are the flows that have these channels have received the most attention. And the idea is there's some radius of curvature, there's a well-defined depth and width, and the flow in this case is coming out of the board. And I don't know why I wrote the Coriolis parameter down there. I'll get to that later. So the idea is when the flow comes, when the sediment-laden flow comes down these channels, as it goes around a corner, there's a centrifugal force which leads to an overspilling, and this levee would build up. When it goes around the other corner, there's also a corresponding overspill in that bend. And Eckhart showed a nice little movie of this process yesterday. So you can directly observe this in some cases. This is a photograph, a seismic image Alex Hay made in British Columbia. Back in the good old days in the 70s, they just used to dump tailing waste from mines directly into the inlet. So this was a man-made underwater distributory network. And so they knew exactly when the turbidity currents went down because it was on the mining schedule, and they could go out and measure this. And in this case, the flow is coming around a corner, and you can see the overspill going over the levee. In this case, it's relatively small. It's only about 100 meters wide. And centrifugal forces are clearly driving that overspill. So when you have that, there's a coupled pattern of erosion and deposition, which leads, if you look at one of these very sinuous channels, in this case it's the Zaire channel, they tend to move. There's an evolution, the sinuosity changes, the bends tend to get to evolve, and they're very sinuous structures. So what causes the sinuosity? It's the deflection of the velocity maximum. So if we start off with a channel that's just slightly sinuous, and we look at where the velocity maximum is and where the erosion is, in this bend here, there's generally some deposition that occurs on the inside of the bend, an erosion at the outside of the bend, and a symmetric case in the other bend. And so this leads to the velocity maximum moving, and the instability reinforces itself in the flow, and the channel gets more sinuous with time. So where these, how the flow couples with where you get erosion and deposition is really important because it controls the evolution of channel growth. And this is, while people argue about the details of this, this general picture is pretty well accepted for how submarine channels evolve. Okay, now what's missing from this picture is, there was a movie and it showed that the Earth's rotating. And I often try to ask my students in their oceanography exam, what's the rotation rate of the Earth? And you know, only half of them can get it right. So I try and remember the Earth rotates once a day. So if you write that in terms of radians, that's the rotational rate of the Earth in radians. Okay, now the Coriolis parameter, it's actually the projection of the Earth's vorticity onto the normal surface of the Earth. So it's only when we're at the North Pole or the South Pole that we actually see all of that rotation rate. If you're near the equator, the projection of the axis is zero. So if you write that out, it's because we're now thinking about the vorticity rather than the rotation rate, it's two times the Earth's rotation rate, once a day, times the sine of the latitude. So at the equator, it's equal to zero. If you're at the North Pole, it's two times the rotation rate. And if you're at about 40 degrees north, which is where most people who write textbooks in Europe and North America live, this is always taken as a sort of canonical mid-latitude Coriolis parameter. And importantly, in the southern hemisphere, it's negative. So in the northern hemisphere, you have positive values. Southern hemisphere, you have negative values. Now, when you're looking at Coriolis acceleration, the change of velocity with time is directly proportional to the velocity at 90 degrees times the Coriolis parameter. So you get strong accelerations when you have high velocities or when you have large Coriolis parameters. If the particle's not moving or it's at the equator, there's no Coriolis accelerations. So that's the first thing to remember. When we go to higher latitudes, there's more influence of the Coriolis forces. Now, something else to remember is that if you're at 45 degrees, now that's halfway to the north or south pole in terms of latitude, but there's actually not much planet left there. So there's only 10% of the surface area of the Earth that's below 45 degrees, 10% above 45 degrees. So this is where Coriolis forces start to be quite strong. Most of the channels people study, the Zaire, the Congo, the Amazon, the channels in the Gulf of Mexico, they're either close to the equator or they're not far from the equator. So 80% of channels you're probably interested on the planet. The rest of my talk is not really relevant for, because Coriolis forces just aren't that important. So it's only at these really high latitude cases that Coriolis forces might be important. Now, for oceanographers, these high latitude locations are really important. It's not turbidity currents oceanographers care about. It's deep, dense flows formed in the Arctic or Antarctic that carry very dense saline brine. And so for all of these flows, Coriolis forces are a first-order description of the flow dynamics. So one of the really important flows that transports cold North Atlantic deep water from between Iceland and Greenland flows through a channel system called the Faroe-Shetland Channel. It goes around here, and it's a major pathway for transporting dense saline water from the Arctic into the North Atlantic. And so here's some pictures that Ilka Fehr, who's an oceanographer in Norway, made, looking upstream in the channel, and this is the velocity maximum. So it's a very wide channel, about 20 kilometers wide, but you can see that this large dense flow, it's here, we're going into the board, so this is on the right-hand side. The flow is strongly deflected to the right-hand side. So all of these large oceanographic flows, using the Coriolis force, it's been accepted for 100 years. You go out and make a field observation, they're moving about a meter per second, and they're strongly influenced by Coriolis forces. So how do we decide when an underwater turbidity current might be influenced by Coriolis forces? The parameter that oceanographers use, it's a Rossby number, not a Rouse number, and it's the ratio of the flow velocity normalized by a length scale and the Coriolis parameter. And so when this Rossby number is much less than 1, that's when Coriolis forces are going to be important. When it's much greater than 1, Coriolis forces can be neglected. So this parameter can be a lot less than 1 if your flow velocity is slow, or if you've got a very large length scale, or the Coriolis parameter is high. So it can be important when the Coriolis parameter is relatively low, as long as your flow velocities are tiny and your length scales are large. So generally, higher latitudes mean lower Rossby numbers, but not always. So that's the main parameter that I'll vary in my lab experiments. In the laboratory, we don't have very large length scales, but we can spin the table very rapidly, so we can get very high F, we can get low. The length scale is normally less than a meter, and the velocity is maybe 10 centimeters per second. So in the lab, we can easily go from Reynolds Rossby numbers much greater than 1 to Rossby numbers much less than 1. Now, the other question is, when are these Coriolis forces going to be important in a sinuous underwater channel? So you could ask the question, how do we compare that Coriolis acceleration, U times F, how does that compare to the centrifugal acceleration? So if we say when these two are equal, we can get a radius that's equal to the velocity divided by the Coriolis parameter, which in oceanography is called the inertial radius. So it's a pretty fundamental property, you see. So at mid-latitudes, if you've got a current moving in a meter per second, it turns out Coriolis forces are more important than curvature when the radius of curvature is greater than 10 kilometers. So it's for big flows, you have to have a very large radius. So if you combine that, when that length scale goes into the Rossby number, that means when you've got a Rossby number of order 1. So Rossby numbers of order 1 have flows where the centrifugal forces are going to be comparable to the Coriolis acceleration. So when Coriolis forces are going to be important. It's for very large flows that aren't particularly sinuous, that have that are at high latitudes. And that's what I'll focus the rest of the talk on. So rather than the earlier picture, where we had this overbanking flow on both the left turning and the right turning corners, when Coriolis forces are important, as I go around this first corner, the centrifugal and the Coriolis forces act together and we get an enhanced overflow. When we go around this corner, they can be in opposition and so we don't get an increase. So here the centrifugal force is going this way, the Coriolis force is going that way, and you get a flat interface. In this corner, you get a super elevated interface. And so the result of this is the one bank, the right-hand bank going downstream tends to be larger than the left-hand bank. And so that's an observation Omar made or quantified back in the 60s, I think. And you can see it quite nicely in this very large underwater channel located at 55 degrees north between Canada and Labrador called the North Atlantic Mid-Ocean Channel. And this is some stratigraphy. And as you go down this channel, it's about 1,000 kilometers long, the right-hand side is always about 100 meters higher than the left-hand side. And this is normally ascribed to Coriolis forces. Now, the other thing, so that channel asymmetry between the left and right-hand sides in the northern and the southern hemisphere, it's the opposite way around, the southern hemisphere is quite well documented and uncontroversial. What's controversial, which Jeff Pickle and myself have been trying to push for, is that there also appears to be a difference in sinuosity, where these channels near the equator, pretty much any channel you want to look at near the equator, they're always very sinuous. Whereas the few channels that exist at high latitudes tend to be straighter. So they tend to be straighter and they tend to have this asymmetry between the left and right side. And you'll also notice that the wavelength or the radius of curvature is a lot larger. So there's some fundamental difference between low latitude and high latitude channels. It could be a number of things. Obviously the sediment supply is different between high and low latitude systems. Some places have had glaciation, near the equator you haven't. I'm going to focus just on what the influence of Coriolis forces might be. Oh, and here's another example that we've been looking at in the southern hemisphere from 60 million years ago. There's a massive formation near Cerro Torre that's also thought to be relatively straight with low sinuosity. It shows an asymmetry to the left in this time, and the paleo reconstruction of the flow also suggests it's very sinuous. So we've got some examples from the northern and southern hemisphere of this. So Jeff Pickle has been thinking about this for a while, and he went through all the literature he could find to work out how does the sinuosity of the flow vary with latitude. So the sinuosity, it's just the straight line distance, a long path distance divided by the straight line distance. So this is quite a sinuous river. And if it was a straight river, it would have a sinuosity of 1. And so when Jeff did this, he found that the low latitude channels tended to have quite high sinuosity, as everyone observed. But then the few examples he could find at latitudes about higher than 40 degrees all were relatively straight. And so after a torturous review process, this was published in Geology. Yeah, and so in rivers, you normally think of this sinuosity as being a function of slope. If you're on a steep slope, rivers tend to be straight. If you're on the flat, they tend to be much more sinuous. So he compared, how does the sinuosity compare with slope? There is some correlation, but there's a much better correlation if you just look at latitude. So that's observational. He suggested at the time that it was due to Coriolis effects, but he didn't have a mechanism. My student Rima Kosu tried to convert this into a Rossby number, because a Rossby number is a direct measure of the effect of Coriolis forces rather than just using latitude. And so when he did this, we may have to make some assumptions about how fast the flows are going, but we know their widths and length scales and everything. And you get a similarly strong correlation between, somewhat strong correlation between all the small ones. All the ones that are relatively straight have relatively low Rossby number. All the ones that have high sinuosity have higher Rossby numbers. And there's quite a big spread there because we have to make some assumptions about what the possible velocities are. Yes?
But presumably you do not believe, you are not claiming that sinuosity is related to Rossby number in the case of high Rossby number.
No,
there will be
no
physical effects that will determine.
Yeah, no, it's more that the straight channels seem to be associated with strong Coriolis forces. So I'll end the talk with a possible mechanism as to why high latitude channels don't become sinuous, but it's still a hypothesis at this stage. Okay, so the first thing we wanted to do was, can you act, if you know the velocity here, can you predict what that interface tilt is? So you can write out the momentum equation and look at a balance between curvature, pressure gradient, and Coriolis term if we ignore acceleration of the flow and neglect the friction term. And this is what Komar did in the 60s, and you've got this very simple relationship that's been widely used but hadn't been tested definitively. And so if you think about this for a straight channel where there's no curvature, you just have this relationship here, and you'd expect that the interface tilt scales linearly with the Coriolis term and inversely with the velocity. So that's what we did. We did a series of experiments where we measured what that tilt was and we compared it with that relationship. Now, in that simple relationship, it was depth averaged, didn't have any effect of Coriolis, any effect of viscosity. And the main effect of viscosity is to introduce Ekman boundary layers, which drive a secondary flow in the flow field. And my colleague, Anna Wallin, had a theory that she'd been using for oceanographic flows where she has a simple representation of the Ekman layers. And so this dotted line is the expectation from Komar's theory. And if you include the Ekman boundary layers, you get a better fit with our experiments. And you can do the same thing in a curved channel, and there's fairly good agreement as well. The other thing that's quite interesting is as you increase the rotation rate, the velocity of the channel flow actually decreases quite a lot. The flow comes into a geostrophic balance and it's no longer driven by just a Fried number condition. So this can be quite significant. This is with no rotation. The flow is moving about 7 centimeters per second. When it's rapidly rotating, it drops down to 4 centimeters per second. And if I write this in terms of a Rossby number, the idea that you can treat a large underwater flow with just a Fried number condition, that's only valid when Coriolis forces aren't important. But all these flow that has Rossby numbers of about 1 are in a geostrophic balance, which is, for oceanographers, that's how they always think about these things. But it might be important for understanding the large underwater turbidity channels. Now, using a velocity probes, we can also see what the secondary flow in these channels are. So when there's no rotation, there's a the flow is coming out of the board, and we get this paired circulation, which is a kind of classic result for rivers. When they're strongly rotating, you get these boundary layers within the flow that are the Ekman boundary layers. So it's in the northern hemisphere sense. We rotate in the southern hemisphere sense. The secondary flow switches over. So there are...
The coupling is velocity?
No, it's velocity. So it's the cross-stream velocity. So this is a schematic of what the sense of the circulation is. And so it's pretty large. It's about 10% of the downstream. The secondary circulation is 10% of the downstream of the circulation. Okay, so there's a picture of REMU. And we also did some experiments in a bend using ADBs and UDBs to measure the velocity field. And this is a picture going through a bend with no rotation. You get super elevation at the outside of the bend. With moderate rotation, you can actually make it super elevate on the inside of the bend. And if you rotate it really strongly, you can make it overflow onto the inside of the bend. And this is a Komar's relationship. And if we test that slope with the observations, it's fairly good agreement. I don't actually have a theory to include friction into this relationship, but Komar's relationship's a good first-order description of the flow.
So the bend is fixed in the experiment, right?
Yeah, in this case, we have a plexiglass wall. Yeah. And we can also look at where's the maximum of the downstream velocity. So with no rotation, the velocity maximum is actually near the center of the channel. If I rotate it strongly, the northern hemisphere sends, the flow is pushed to the right, and the velocity maximum is also pushed to the right. So if you had an erodible bed, you'd expect to see more erosion here and perhaps deposition here. Whereas if you do it at the southern hemisphere sense, at the bend, you actually have the velocity maximum on the inside bend. So what, in effect, if we measure where the velocity maximum is at the bend, above the bend, and below the bend, this is the picture we get. If you're at the equatorial sense, where the velocity maximum alternates between sides. That's the classical picture everyone has. As you go around the bend, centrifugal forces push the velocity to the outside of the bend. You go around the next bend, it gets pushed to the outside of the bend. However, when we rotate strongly the northern hemisphere sense, the flow is always on the right. In the southern hemisphere sense, it's always on the left. And if we do a really simple experiment, where I just add some silicon carbide, okay. Silicon carbide that settles out of suspension really quickly. With no rotation, the silicon carbide turbidity current just settles evenly through the channel. Rotating the southern hemisphere sense, it all settles on the left-hand side. Northern hemisphere sense, it all settles on the right-hand side. So to be a bit more quantitative, we tried to have an erodible bed using a fine plastic particles, and we had a traversing mechanism where we could measure the bed thickness before and after the passage of a saline gravity current. And there's me, the scale. So this is the result. So red means there's been deposition, blue means there's been erosion. We had two different channels, one that was relatively straight and one that was more sinuous. And so at the equator, this is the situation that would be relevant for all the major channels that people have already studied. So this picture reproduces the results people already have found before, in that just after the channel bed, you get a zone of deposition. So after both channel bends, there's deposition, and you get erosion on the outside of the channel bends. And that holds for the more sinuous case and the less sinuous case. But if you're rotating strongly in the northern hemisphere sense, all the erosions on the right-hand side, all the depositions on the left. In the southern hemisphere sense, it flips around, it's all on the left and deposition on the right. And it's even more pronounced in the straight channels. So that's quite a strong experimental observation. We can quantify that a bit more by Remu circled two regions, and he just worked out what the difference in thickness was. So he's calling these lateral accretion packages, and he's trying to work out what's the average depth of that compared to the average depth of that as a way to measure the asymmetry. So one on Rossby number, zero now represents non-rotating cases, and large one on Rossby number is strongly rotating cases. So these are relatively symmetric to experimental error when there's no rotation, and then you can see a pronounced shift going from left to right as we go to northern southern hemisphere. And we did this at two locations within the flow, so that's why there's these different trends. So the straighter channel and the more sinuous channel both display the same trend. So a conceptual picture of how high latitude channels evolve is that the flow is always deflected to one side. You always get accretion packages on one side, and the channel should just sift. There's no mechanism now for it to become sinuous. So if it can never become sinuous, it'll stay straight. So rather than having a So at the equator, there's a very well-described mechanism to make it sinuous, but it appears at high latitude, there isn't the same mechanism now, as long as the Rossby number is less than one. So here's a picture summarizing all of this. This is the suspension fallout, so where particles rain down and the traction dominated where there's erosion. What is speculative about this picture is how the stratigraphy evolves, and we haven't actually shown definitively in the experiments, because the walls can't erode, how the sinuosity will erode. So I'm trying to write a kinematic model to take into this account of this. So this is believed, well, at the equator. This is what we're speculating happens at high latitudes. And we speculate that this explains the difference between this channel at 60 degrees north and that channel at 5 degrees north. So this is a summary of my results. And if you've got any questions, I'd be glad to take them.
You've explained why the channels get less sinuous because of the Coriolis effect, essentially, right?
Well, not why they get less sinuous, but why they don't become sinuous.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is irrelevant then, but why are they sinuous to begin with in the equatorial area? And, I mean, those of us who decades ago took courses in fluvial morphology.
Yep.
Never explain the meandering pattern. Is any of that related to what you
well, I think it's
insights
that
there?
It's where the velocity gets pushed out, you get more erosion, and then the channel. So there's an instability that reinforces itself, and that also leads to the pattern moving downstream slightly. So it's the same. Gary Parker has discussed this in many papers at great length, and it's the same mechanism. It's thought to be the same mechanism for rivers as for turbidity channels. So I guess the channel challenge for turbidity currents is really ground truthing it against the stratigraphy. When I look at the stratigraphy, it's terrifying, but those of us who maybe do it more often could comment on that. So what part of the problem is there's a lot of really good stratigraphy at the equator because that's where a lot of the oil exploration is going on. At high latitudes, for various reasons, there hasn't been a lot of oil exploration, so it's sort of challenging to verify if that lateral shift actually occurs. There's some indication of it for the Namoff or the Cerro Torre formation, but because I'm not a geologist, you know, I have a lot of challenges reading these stratigraphy papers.
Fascinating talk. So if I'm reading this correctly, you would expect that for the majority of channels, those which are sinuous, the sedimentary architectures should roughly mimic those that you see in fluvial systems. Am I correct? Because the secondary circulation patterns are basically the same.
Well, you know, there's all that discussion whether they're river-like or reverse river-like. But beyond that, my understanding of the stratigraphy is that these equatorial ones should look more or less like the riverine systems, according to people.
Not the distributary system.
Yeah, down on the plain where you've got these channel networks developing. Does that answer your question?
It does, yeah.
I'm just confused because you should treat the problem of meandering in rivers just as a something very local in which the things that matter are the width of the river and, let's say, the flow depth and things like that, nothing about the big scale effect that you're mentioning. And also, the evolution of the bed is crucial for that. Okay, so you cannot have, so it will reverse the sense of the secondary source if you have a bed free to evolve. So if you do it in an experiment in which the bed is fixed, then it will evolve differently than with a bed free to evolve, okay?
Yeah.
Because it will change the flow depth along the cross section, that one, okay? So I would like you to speculate on this, and also, I know the meander problem like something in which you start from a straight river and then it will increase its sinuosity continuously, so up to cutoff. So the typical example in meanders is that the sinuosity grows and grows and grows.
Yeah.
Typically the wavelengths stay fixed and the amplitude of the meanders grow. At some times it will cut off and so you will have a straight reach again. And then the process will start again. So I'm wondering if it's something similar in the...
Yeah, so the mechanism that's always described for those growth of the meanders, it has to do ignoring your question about the secondary circulation, a lot of people say it's where the velocity maximum is. So those theories of Parker and numerous others, it's where the lateral velocity maximum is. And so if you go around the corner, centrifugal forces push it to the outside bank, and then it's thought to be, this might be a phase lag of where you get the maximum erosion. And so then you get erosion maybe slightly after the bend, and that increases the bend, increases the centrifugal force, and there's a positive feedback. So with here, what we're saying is that if the Coriolis force is stronger than the centrifugal force, you could always have the velocity maximum on the left or right hand side. And so then you don't have any feedback where there's this, a bend gets bigger with time. So you cut off the mechanism to produce the feedback. And it's more pronounced in these underwater channels because the density difference between seawater and the turbidity currents is much less than the difference between air and water. So you can quite easily get a very strong super elevation on the left or right side. It's a lot more pronounced than you would in the river.
I mean, I guess I don't completely understand how the sinuosity can be completely suppressed, because there, what would seem to me would be that even though the channel as a whole is going to do to one side, if you create a perturbation on that grid, that you would see an amplification of that perturbation because of the same mechanism as in the original sinuosity failure. So, it seems to me there may be some higher order connection between the sinuosity and grip that would suppress the sinuosity. But at lowest order, the level of linear perturbation, I mean, maybe you said it and I just didn't get it, but it's hard for me to understand how you could eliminate linear instability.
Well, I've got to do the maths to check that it does work. But I think if you're in a situation, imagine you're in a situation where there's no, you can work out how big the perturbation is due to a small bump, and then you have to ask, is that going to be larger than the Coriolis force that's present there? And
well, the Coriolis force just drives a net drift. So the question is, why does the sinuosity, is the sinuous instability on top of that drift not amplify as it would in the case of the river?
Well, and that's really
linear
smaller,
order, I suspect they don't
interact. Yeah. I mean, if you have a little bump here, the flow is still all on the left, that's where the erosion is. You're not going to push it over to the other side, so I think it will just decay with time. It depends on the Rossby number. You have to have a really, this is assuming a really small Rossby number, and there's obviously going to be some limit here where Coriolis forces aren't important, and these small perturbations do keep growing. So I have to do it formally to work out, you know, what is the threshold for which finite perturbations decay. The math isn't trivial.
Because it doesn't like, it's in the river case, is a force problem. So it's something which it will grow forever. You cannot have a saturation that stops the linear.
Yeah, but it's because the it's in phase, that's where you have the feedback. So here you cut off the mechanism for it to be in phase. So, you know, the reason it grows is because the perturbation reinforces itself. So now if you cut off you increase the channel band, you increase the centrifugal force, that leads to more erosion, which feeds back on itself here, you don't have that feedback mechanism. So that's my thought. But that's qualitative, you know, I need to do a formal mathematical sense to show that.
Jared? So you made a very short mention of this, I think, but I want to talk about other influences.
Yeah.
So the Amazon, the Zaire, or the Congo, we should say now, the Bengal fan, these are all low latitude, really large systems that are fed by rivers supplying enormous amounts of clay minerals.
Yeah.
And they are very large as well. So we have flow size and we have the characteristics of the sediment, which drive entirely the flow dynamics and also stratigraphic things like building up the levees. So there is a whole range of other influences than
definitely the sediment type could be important. The flow volume, though, is sort of taken account in the Rossby number because that determines the velocity and the width. So, but trying to describe what the effect of sediment type is, not being a geologist, that's a really clear difference between low latitudes and high latitudes.
Do you have any idea whether I mean, it's going to be a discussion of which effects are more important at some point.
Yeah. Right?
Any clue whether those things could be really important, or you have no idea?
Well, obviously they'll be somewhat important. As coming from a more physics background, trying to just understand the physical processes of how the centrifugal and Coriolis forces might play out. But if you wanted to have a full description, I don't really understand what the differences of clays versus non-cohesive sediments might make to the evolution of the channel architecture.
Well, I guess it would completely change the density profile and the velocities.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Would it change where you got erosion deposition with respect to going around the corner?
Well,
the evolution of levees?
I don't know the definitive answer to that, but I would expect that it changes things like secondary circulation and where the velocity maximum is, because it completely changes where density is vertically in the earth, and we have no understanding at all about whether this really how this changes the behavior at the upper interface versus what happens at the bed and where erosion and deposition is really located.
Yeah.
So I would think it's that those
it's probably quite important. Well, I'll try and understand the simple problem first, and then I'll ask more challenging questions. Yeah, but that's always the standard. When I talk to geologists, you know, the obvious difference between the equator and high latitudes is there's a different source of sediment type is different,
yeah,
as well as the Coriolis forces being different. So it's not obvious to disentangle the two.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, if the evolution ends up being sort of more, you'd say, because of the, say, slope being a little bit greater, it ends up being a bit straighter, and if you're at 30 degrees, I mean, do you expect some effect at that latitude? I'm sort of looking at the northern part of the Gulf.
Well, something you do see is you do see a asymmetry between levees, even as low as 30 degrees, but there doesn't seem to be any channels that are those low latitudes that are not highly sinuous. So it might be that, you know, some of the effects of the left-right levee asymmetry come into play before the changes to channel sinuosity.
Even the more proximal points?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't spent the time looking at all the stratigraphy. I'd love to have someone to collaborate with who could sort of show me how to look at all the stratigraphy. So, not being a geologist, I find a lot of the stratigraphy a bit inaccessible.
One thing that you might want to look at is the alternation at the levee height. You know, say if your theory is working out, around the equator, the levees that are high should be alternating.
Yeah, exactly.
And then in the other, you know, as you move towards the
The levee asymmetry is quite well established. Like most levees you look at,
right,
you know, northern, further north than 30 degrees or further south.
Yeah.
So look, like there's some coming off New Zealand and they're always higher on the left hand
right
side.
But in this one that maybe around the equator, there should be some.
Yeah, yeah. So near the equator they always alternate.
Yeah.
So that's quite well established. That's not controversial, I didn't think.
Yeah.
What is controversial is why they appear to be straighter at high latitudes. So I'm saying it's because it's the shift in the velocity maximum. But I've been having a bit of trouble convincing reviewers about that.
Okay, if there are no questions, we can thank